Okay, so this is Keith Ulick. We're back from the intermission with Glenn Kenny, Karina Longworth, and Vadim Razov. And before we get back into Cannes, Karina would like to speak about a very interesting topic related to the tavern we're currently in.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to give a little bit of a dispatch from the ladies' room. There's an interesting dialogue going on in the graffiti on the wall. In big black letters, it says something like, I can't quote word for word, I'm sorry, but it says something like, fuck you forever, you cunts. And then in small green letters, it says, what's the matter? You don't like women, puppy boy?
Well, and so what does this say about womankind in New York City and in this part of
the
century?
Nothing that I haven't already said about the Sex and the City movie.
I haven't been in a ladies' room since I was a custodian at the student center of William Patterson College around 1978.
You were a custodian too?
Yeah, the most memorable graffiti from that era was a guy named Bob Roth was the director of the student center, and somebody wrote on the wall of the stall, Bob Roth is a fox, and somebody else responded, well, he smells like one.
What do foxes smell like?
It didn't,
well,
I mean...
I actually have the
implication was not good.
I have a story about that, and I think it's from the Christopher Isherwood book about smelling like a fox. I don't remember who it was specifically. I don't think it was E.M. Forster, but I think it was someone...
I think it was some other gay writer.
It was Cyril Connolly, I believe, who smelled so much like a fox.
No. It was this acquaintance of Isherwood's who said that he paid a young trick, essentially to not bathe himself for 30 days.
And then to come
to his house after the 30 days time. And he wrote in his diary afterwards that, yes, the boy came to me and he smelled just like a fox.
Well, that's exactly what I think the graffiti I've cited was meant to evoke.
I guess the man didn't shower for 30 days, so there you go.
Well.
So speaking of not showering for 30 days, back to Ken. So let's talk, Karina and Glenn. You seem to be in agreement on a lot of films. Were there any, though, that both of you disagreed on?
What did you see, Glenn?
I saw quite a bit.
I saw a lot of films in the market, and I think that you didn't see.
You saw more films in the market. I saw more films in the competition, I think. Did you see the Olivier Assayas film?
Yeah.
Yeah, again, not to be boring, we both agreed on it.
Okay.
It's a fabulous...
This is Summer Hours.
Yeah. Is that the return to form, or do you guys disagree?
No, I don't think it's a return to form, because I think Assayas has been spot on.
I didn't see Boarding Gate.
I lost it after Demon Lover. After Demon Lover, I've been gone.
I didn't see Boarding Gate. I liked Demon Lover, but I didn't think it was very good.
Well, it's fantastic. Boarding Gate is like made me want to shoot myself.
But I like it that he's gone back to sort of like not being so analytical about, technology and the global marketplace, and actually talking about people, and incidentally talking about technology.
He got to Chris in Boarding Gate, where he was on the verge of self-parody. It was like they will go to a karaoke bar, and someone will get an LCD projector on their face, and they will go into this internationalism karaoke thing.
No, I think Boarding Gate was a very deliberate genre move on his part. But to go back to Summer Hours, I agree with you, Karina, on it being about people, but one of the great things about it is that it's not just about people, but it is about an idea. It's about an idea, the idea of how the film, which has been bought by IFC for U.S. distribution,
Ryan Werner loves it, as well he should.
It's about a sort of haute bourgeois family.
It's kind of about Frenchness.
Yeah, it's about Frenchness. Their mother passes away, and she leaves them this amazing art collection and this amazing collection of furniture and artifacts, and they're all in conflict over whether they should sell the house and the things in it or whether they should try and preserve it. And ironically enough, the guy who wants to preserve the whole thing is an economist. He's an economist who doesn't believe in economics, and he's sort of put at war with his siblings.
And he's kind of like the doppelganger for Assayas.
Yeah. But there's never any horrible hostility. It's very Renoir-esque in that everyone in the film has their reasons. And aside from the really beautiful personal drama that plays out, and I gotta give great praise to the cast, Charles Burling,
Juliette Binoche.
Beautiful Juliette Binoche, and Jeremy Renier, for the first time in my experience.
And in his other movie, it can. The Darden film. Polar opposite character.
Here he's playing a really balanced, a good guy. Everybody in the film is a good person.
Family man.
You know, and they
and
have
then in
this
the Darden
conflict.
Film, he's a junkie.
He's a junkie. Yeah. He's a very sympathetic junkie.
Yeah.
But what this movie is about, it's about how art functions in two contexts. The context of a family life and a home, and how it functions in the context of a museum. Because this film, like Hu Xiaoxian's Flight of the Red Balloon.
And they were both spawned from the same project.
Yeah, sponsored by the Musée d'Orsay.
Okay. Okay.
So what happens is a lot of this art ends up at the Musée d'Orsay, and it's not condemnatory, but it really does examine how art functions when it's part of an actual family life and very much a component of their own interaction and love for each other, and how art functions when it's kind of like... The idea is that a museum, for better or worse, will embalm art.
Right.
And there's a beautiful scene at the end where the teenage daughter
Charles
Berling character goes to the emptied-out old house. And it's the beautiful thing is it's not condemnatory. It sees these young people as bringing their own energy and their own creativity to this thing. So there's this great sense of continuity to it. But the thing about the film is that it's so perfectly judged. All the performances are fantastic. Asayas's script is so right on. There's that beautiful point.
But there isn't like the same kind of easy flash that he's had in a lot of his movies lately.
Why did this movie get shunted off to the site?
It wasn't shunted off.
It actually had opened in France.
And so it was impossible for it to open at Cannes.
Yeah.
I see. But it played at Berlin, which seems like just like throwing your cards in early, you know.
And it might have something to do with the Orsay Commission or whatnot, but it opened in France. It did fairly well in France.
No, according to Ryan Werner, it was a huge hit in France. Like,
it's a beautiful film. It's a film that when it comes out here, I think we'll both be championing. People should see it.
But at
they'll
the same
get a lot
time,
of pleasure
like, I feel
out
like,
of it.
I feel like the way that we're describing it makes it sound like an art wink.
Right.
And it isn't necessarily. It really is about the way, it is about, I don't know.
This sounds
even more wanky, but it's about feeling.
No, that's the thing. I didn't mean to make it sound wanky, but the great thing about the movie is that it is about this particular idea, but it doesn't play that way at all. It's a really warm, engaging, funny family drama at the same time that it is dealing with a particular idea.
I think that another movie that I saw in the market, which is a little bit less wanky, is the movie that I named as my
less
favorite
putatively
film.
Wanky.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's the film that I named as my favorite film at Cannes, which nobody else saw.
Everything is Fine?
Yeah.
Mm.
Did
you see
which I wish I'd seen based on Karina's recommendation.
I love that film so much. It's basically the French-Canadian Paranoid Park, but with no homoerotic subtext. And it's, but it's, it goes, I think it goes a lot deeper in its main character's psyche. And man, I fell in love with this film so hard, and I was telling everybody to go see it. There was like one other market screening after I saw it, and I did get a couple of people to go see it. I got Britt Withy, who programs the Denver Film Festival, to see it, and so he's going to program it because he fell in love with it too.
Yeah.
Oh God, it's so good.
Well, let me ask you something though. I mean, you're talking very passionately about a lot of these films, and I wonder though, with this punishing kind of schedule that you sort of have, that you sort of adhere to. I don't know whether necessarily by choice or by dictate. I mean, I think it's probably a little bit of both. But do you feel like there were any films that kind of confounded you that because of the schedule and you wanted to kind of give another chance?
There were a lot of films that I fell asleep in. And
okay.
I'll admit that. Like, I fell asleep in Tokyo, the omnibus film.
Okay.
I fell asleep during the second segment. I saw the Gondry segment, and then I fell asleep during, I guess it was the Cross segment.
The Karak segment, and then were you awake for the Bong Joon-ho?
No, I realized that I had slept through the entire Karak segment, and then I left.
Here we go.
But that was an interesting thing, because I went to a buyer screening of that, and I got into the buyer screening, and I got a seat. But in a lot of these buyer screenings, they were, like, filling up the aisles with people sitting on the floor.
Right.
Just to get people in it.
Right.
And in order to leave that screening when I knew that I was too tired to be in it anymore, I had to climb over people. And so a little old lady like sat in my seat after I left, and then immediately after I exited the theater, I realized that I had left my jacket behind.
Ooh.
So I had to climb over people again and then ask the little old lady to give me my jacket back.
Right.
So that was probably like my biggest faux pas at Cannes.
Okay. And
I zoned out during the Lucretia Martel film.
Okay.
Which I didn't even go there to see because my roommates told me that it was like an art installation and not a film.
No, what I saw of it, I thought was really interesting, and then when I discussed it with a friend of mine, Tom Carson, afterwards, I realized that I really fucking blew it. Not through any willfulness, it was just...
Right.
This thing about Cannes is like you get there and you're like going, oh wow,
you can't see everything.
You're like, oh wow, isn't this interesting? I can stay out till 2 o'clock every night and yet get to the 8:30 movie every morning, and then on the fourth day you're like at the 4:30, 6:30 screen, you're like, oh my god, then you're dead.
Yeah. Right.
So no. The thing about the Martel film is that it's so thoroughly nuanced that if you zone out during it, you're totally lost.
Right.
So I actually relied upon some friends to fill me in on it, and that's a film that I'm eager to see again because what I did discern from it was very interesting, but by the same token, I can't say I was able to make any kind of really informed critical judgment on it.
I feel the same way about Lorna's Silence, which was the Dardenne film there, okay. Which is I was awake for... What happened for me during due to my schedule and all that was that I tended to be awake for the first 5 minutes of a film, then fall asleep for the next 15 or 20 minutes, and then snap awake and be completely alert for the rest of it.
Right.
So that happened to me in the Dardenne film, and what I was awake for the Dardenne film really has stuck with me, and I keep thinking about that film, but I feel like I completely cannot review it because I slept through 20 minutes.
Well, this is interesting.
Falling asleep at film festivals, you can be, the hailest...
And I were at Sarasota, and I fell asleep in probably every movie we went to together.
Yeah,
you can be the hailest, hardiest, most awake person in the known universe, and you will fall asleep at a film. Remember the first time I went to Toronto, I went to see Abbas Kiarostami's The Wind Will Carry Us. I sat next to Dave Kerr.
Oh, no.
One of my...
I bet Dave Kerr is the kind of guy who insists that he never falls asleep in films.
No, Dave is not. Dave won't front. Dave is an honest guy, but Dave is Dave, and Dave is someone I've revered for a long time, and I think he's got one of the most amazing, idiosyncratic eyes of any film critic. Yeah. I sat there, and I fell the fuck asleep during The Wind Will Carry Us, which is... acknowledged as one of the most, and
But if you've seen four films that day, it's hard.
I eventually revisited it. 4 o'clock is my bad time. 4 o'clock is always my bad time.
For me, it's the first screening of the day.
Yeah.
Now, how much of the schedule for seeing all these films is dictated by your job or dictated by you? I mean,
nobody tells me what to see.
Nobody. When you were at Premiere,
that's very different for most people, I would say.
When I was at Premiere, I was playing a kind of double game because for 2 years that I was at Premiere going to Cannes, I was also asked by Mike Goodridge of Screen International to be on the Cannes competition critics jury. So that kind of locked me into seeing all the competition films. This year I was free to do whatever I wanted or not wanted. So, I went to see The Chaser instead of 24 City, which probably turned out to be a mistake.
Well, although The Chaser did get picked up. I thought 24 City was...
24 City is the...
That's the Gia Zhang
film. Amy Tobin loves it. Jim Hoberman loves it. But
I knew I'd be able to see it again on the rebound. I didn't know about The Chaser. I didn't know that The Chaser had been picked up for a remake by Warner Brothers and that IFC was going to pick it up.
Well, considering that I just tentatively announced the Charlie Kaufman blogathon today...
I didn't see Synodesk because I stayed out way too late the night before. And I ended up sleeping until 11.
Well, Glenn, how about your thoughts?
I did see Charlie Kaufman's film, and I liked it. I was a little taken aback by it because I wasn't...
Was it completely as scatologically obsessed as I'd heard?
It was fairly scatologically obsessed, and I'm thinking
that... Sex in the City, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking that this year, unfortunately, I mean... I'm not big on scatological humor or scatological content in general.
But jokes are in the culture.
But, you know, I saw Stuck last week, the new Stuart Gordon film, which opens with Mina Suvari changing a
very
elderly
shitty
man's
very
corn-filled
shitty
diaper. I understand that there's a scatological reference in Sex and the City film. This goes back to...
And there was a Margaret at the Wedding as well.
Margaret at the Wedding. I was going to say that. This is one trend that I am not in favor of. The human shit on screen thing.
No, I don't like that either. No.
And
what do you think of Sayla?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I don't like.
I mean, there's one thing to do it in like a political sense. There's another thing to do it in Sex and the City.
It's so funny because recently Roger Kimball, the conservative art critic, was blogging about some apparently turned out to be fraudulent Yale art student doing. A piece based on all her miscarriages, and he brought up the Buñuel film L'Âge d'Or, and he brought up this Orwell essay in which Orwell cites L'Âge d'Or as featuring explicit scenes of a woman defecating, which
it doesn't,
and yet Roger Kimball's been able to maintain, and he's been riding this hobby horse for a while, maintain this slander against the film for years based on George Orwell's misinterpretation of a Henry Miller review of the film. But now we actually do have films where human shit or the simulation thereof is featured. And unfortunately, Synecdoche, New York, does feature Philip Seymour Hoffman hugging a toilet bowl and sort of poking around his feces and saying, "I think I have blood in my feces." This is indicative of the character and indicative of the character's... It's indicative of his doleful middle age, and as I said in my blog post, you know, he becomes, heir to the thousand. He becomes victim of the thousand shocks that the flesh is heir to. As a middle-aged man, I don't necessarily begrudge him his obsessions, but I don't necessarily want to see them enacted in a film. That said, Synecdoche, New York is an incredibly despairing film. It's interesting because even the humor of it is not funny. I didn't laugh at it at all. It's a legitimate work of art, but it's a really scary, despairing, and uncompromisedly bleak film. And you know, When you go into Cannes and you see people saying, well, buyers are lukewarm about it, the impression that you get is like, well, that it's a substandard piece.
Yeah, but, right.
But what it is
a lot
not
of the
substandard.
Films in Cannes this year that buyers were lukewarm about weren't shitty films. They were just difficult films.
They were uncompromising films.
Can we talk about the Depardon for a bit? Because I have lots of obsession.
Because
I believe the only New York screening of Profiles of Farmers Day of Their Life was the one I saw at BAM. I showed it 2 times, and that was it. And I think 10th District Court is like one of the best things ever. So
I love A Christmas Tale. Do you like it?
I love A Christmas Tale very much.
Oh my god!
I think it's an incredible.
Despardon.
Did you see Depardon or Despardon?
I did say Depardon. I like Despardon.
Depardon actually like
the Depardon.
He made a really fantastic film again.
The Depardon thing is, you know, we went to see it showed at BAM 2 times. In one night, and that was it for New York, as far as I know.
I think that both of those films are on my top
five. Yeah, no, I noticed that. Depardon makes Despardon look like he's a major filmmaker on the American market, but...
Well, I think that both of those films could succeed on a small level. But I think that Despardon could be like... Despardon is basically the French Royal Tenenbaums, except made in a virtuosic style.
That made me about 50% less excited.
A friend of mine said it was like Salinger
on
steroids.
Me too. But you see that, like, you understand that it's that in the first 15 minutes, and then it continues to defy your expectations for an hour and a half.
Oh no, the emotions of A Christmas Tale are so raw.
But the characters are so well drawn. I mean, that's really the difference between him and whatever Wes Anderson or anybody that you compare it to, is that he makes his characters feel not only real, but like, get so sucked into their lives and like their motivations. I mean,
well, I'm not going to take this opportunity to defend Wes Anderson, but in A Christmas Tale, Despardon has the Matthew Amalric character is kind of one of the most amazing acting jobs you've ever seen, because he starts off at a level of madness that's like, he starts off pretty high, then he has to take it higher, and he never overplays it.
But it always seems like somebody you might know.
Right. He never overplays it. He never makes it alienating. And yet, he gets to the crazy in such an acute and specific way that you just sit there and you go, like, oh, my God. I mean, he's...
Did you guys edit these podcasts?
Yes, but I usually let people ramble. By request, really. I mean, that's all.
Amalric is brilliant, and what's even more brilliant is the understated way in which Catherine Deneuve, as his mother, reacts to him.
It's such like a French film star cast.
Yeah.
So people who watch French films are like, oh, it's him and her and him and her.
Yeah.
But regular Americans weren't going to
But then you start forgetting about it and just get into their lives and their story, and it's very...
Oh, man, it's so fucking good.
Brilliant. It's a brilliant film.
All right, well, what about now hated films? Like, is there anything that really, really worked?
I thought that 24 City was terrible, but I know that a lot of people really like it.
I walked
out 45 minutes before the end because I wanted to try to make a Vicky Cristina Barcelona screening.
Okay.
But I thought it was completely interminable. Like, I mean, even the stories that are real felt fake. And
right.
It seemed so staged to me. It's like such like a bad high school theater production.
Okay.
But I know that Amy Taubin and Jim Hoffman are in love with it. So.
I didn't actually, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, well, the competition this year was kind of underwhelming. And because there was nothing that sort of like stood out and really blew people away in the way that maybe No Country for Old Men did last year. But I thought the competition was really pretty solid in that, particularly for me, there were no films that I like despised and just wanted to walk out on. I mean, I was really dreading Sorrentino's film Il Divo about Giulio Andreotti, the Italian politician, because I had seen his film A Friend of the Family the year before, and I thought that was one of the most intolerable things ever. And I sat through the goddamn thing all the way to the end because I wanted to be able to say to people, this is one of the most intolerable things ever. And yet even Il Divo, which, you know, walked away with an award from the jury, was, you know, a creditable film. So I thought that, like, even though there wasn't anything there that kind of, like, stood out and blew people away the way that No Country for Old Men did, although if you take Todd McCarthy's review of Changeling into account, you might think that that was the case, because Todd, you know, who's been growing more effusive over the years when he likes something, seemed to like Changeling almost as much as he liked No Country for Old Men, but there was nothing there that really just blew people away in that particular way. And yet, there were really impressive films there. The De Plachin film, a really fucking, excuse my French, a really fucking substantial film.
Okay.
Che, a really interesting film worth arguing about. Changeling, Clint Eastwood's film, a really interesting, engaging, angry movie. The thing about Clint Eastwood's movie is that it makes you laugh at Pauline Kael's review of Dirty Harry, because with the benefit of hindsight, the benefit of all these years of Eastwood films over the years, you see that this film, Changeling, and Dirty Harry both partake of a very strong anti-authoritarian streak. You know, Dirty Harry's not a fascist. Dirty Harry's... Well, maybe he is a fascist, but he's a fascist who's rebelling against the authority in charge. And the thing about Changeling is that it's very angry.
Yeah.
It's very, even though it's a period piece and it takes place in the late 20s, it's bristling with anger over the way bureaucracies and police authorities are run. So that was, to me, very interesting. So to me, I thought, yeah, maybe there wasn't anything that kind of like ran ahead of the pack and said, you know, this is a genius film that's going to, like, galvanize audiences whenever it comes out. But by the same token, it's, like, a handful of films that are going to, like, be well worth debating if and when they see release here in America. So, for me, it was very satisfying.
So why don't you give me any closing thoughts on Cannes that you have?
Well, I'm just glad I went. I mean, it was...
Yeah.
The thing about Cannes is that... Speaking particularly for myself,
yeah,
it has a romance that is very attached to the auteurs that I grew up revering, you know,
right.
That Buñuel got honored for Viridiana in the early 60s, Fellini for La Dolce Vita,
right.
And walking up the Croisette on a beautiful night in the starlight and seeing all the madness, you can sort of detach from the madness and see what it was about this festival that is so sort of seductive. David Cronenberg talks about it as being, you know, a place where you make film deals at 4 o'clock in the morning on a corner the way most people make drug deals. And the brilliant thing about Cannes, which Sundance doesn't really get, is that it's the big tent of everything. It honors filmmakers, it honors auteurs, and at the same time it's the most venal, circus-like market you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it has all
but
of
I
that.
Think that. I think that good stuff has a better chance of shining at Cannes than this at Sundance.
Right.
Because it does honor filmmakers. It does still love filmmakers.
I mean, even though the critics hated that Garel film, they still had a huge red carpet. Because the actors are famous in France.
And that Garel film is fucking awesome.
I love it.
As you and I both agree on that.
Variety wrote that, like, it might lose him his fan base after Rizzo.
Oh, my God. That Variety review is the biggest piece of bullshit I've ever read. The fact that, like, Leslie, whatever... I'm being such a shitty journalist right now saying that. But
Leslie,
I'm looking for it, I think. Just the fact that, like, she referred to the main character as a bitch in the review.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
It's like, how does that jive with Peter Bart's language exactly?
Now, do you know who that actress is?
Laura Smet. Yeah, you were telling me that she's
right,
the daughter.
Right, we were talking about she's the daughter of Johnny Holiday and Natalie Bay.
Oh, my God.
That is like French pop culture royalty.
Awesome. Now,
paired up against Louis Garrel, the ultra-sultry boy.
Yeah, the most attractive 26-year-old man in France.
It's so funny because he is so not the if you see him in... He came to the luncheon for a Rendezvous with French Cinema.
He's like a hip-hop guy, right?
And he's a hip-hop guy.
He
wears a wool cap. He's really congenial and all smiley, but in his films, especially the films directed by his father, he's very much like...
He's being his father's doppelganger from the 60s.
Yeah, he's in a sulk all the time. He's like what they...
Man, I love that movie.
That Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon where Bullwinkle takes up method acting and says, I've got the ultra-sultry look, you know? Louis Garrel has the ultra-sultry look,
Glenn,
but he sells
it. Talk about like how everybody was all pissed off about the old-timey horror effects.
About the old-time... Yeah, that was so ridiculous. I mean...
I thought that was so...
It was
so
beautiful.
In line with everything he was doing, with all like the irises and everything.
Yeah, he used the Garrel film. He used the iris out. He used
Leave
the...
Like, you, me, Danny Kasman. Like, I can't think of anybody else who's really into that movie, but we all love it.
He used the effects of Méliès and Franju to do a mirror version of The Ghost of the Beloved, and it was actually very beautiful. And these people
so
in the
beautiful.
Fucking
I mean,
Lumiere.
It's actually scary.
Yeah.
When she first shows up in the mirror,
it's
so
effective.
Scary.
And the people in the Lumiere had to, like, advertise their sophistication by laughing really ostentatiously at these effects.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not really a Garel fan based on the three
I've
seen.
I know. We saw a Garel film together in Sarasota and neither of us liked it.
Which film?
I Can Still Hear the Guitar.
Yeah,
I Can No Longer Hear the Guitar.
Yeah. No,
it's a good movie. It's a good movie.
The three I've seen have made me want to kill myself.
That's the whole point, dude. There are parts of that film that I like.
But you see,
film
this
is
the thing.
I mean, if that film is here...
Yeah.
You know, Frontier of Dawn is fucking here.
Okay,
I'm putting my hands very far apart.
And the thing is, hearing you guys talk about it is getting me to see it. So, you know, let me
make it.
Where did I put it on my list?
A slight digression.
Number two.
Yeah.
My fascination with Louis Garrel dates from my being 13 years old and buying the Nick. Dates from my being 13 years old and buying the Nico album, The End, Island Records, which features her singing the Doors song, The End, and also her singing Das Liebe der Deutsches, with Brian Eno making blitz sounds in the background.
Wow.
And the front cover and the back cover are both stills. It says, front cover, a still from the film La Cicatrice Interieure, by Philippe Garrel. And I was like, you know, 14 years old, living in Dumont, New Jersey, and I was like, who is this Garrel guy? And it was only in the past 5 or 6 years that, you know, I was able to see his films. But I've been, like, hawking on that one thing since forever.
And so did they live up to your dream, or how did they come?
Well, there was one film I saw by Garrel that was nothing but 90 minutes of close-up black-and-white shots of Nico and Gene Seberg. I forget what it was called. It is amazing. It showed at BAM. But, you know, yeah, no, it did not disappoint. So,
interesting.
A friend of mine, well, Kent Jones said, you know, there's a certain mood of a Garrel film. There's a certain thing that happens. And what Ken said to me, all he needs to do is turn on a camera and the Garrel thing happens.
But
that's true.
You have to be really patient about it. I mean, even with Frontier of Dawn, like the second act means nothing.
Right.
I saw Regular Lovers at the Cinema Village and went with a really bad chip on my shoulder because I had seen The Birth of Love and I hated it. But I was 15, so what the hell do I know? You know,
right.
I was watching it, I was like, this is fun. I'm having a lot of fun watching
this. Well, I mean,
but there's these two girls behind me in an all-American apparel couture. And every
American Apparel
after the 2 hour mark, you're like, every 10 minutes, they're like, when will this end? And there's that fake out.
Why were they there?
I don't know. But they're like, they're sitting there like, when will this end? And then, you know, you think it's about to end, and there's the dream sequence. And I'm like, oh my God, when will it end? And I'm like, and I also really like Elizabeth Town, which I don't expect anyone to go along with. But it was kind of the same screening atmosphere, just like people like, why does this movie exist? It's like, fuck you, just watch the movie.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I think that was probably what the press screening atmosphere for Frontier of Dawn was like.
No, like, I don't care about your reaction.
When I saw Frontier of Dawn, I didn't go to the press screening. Apparently they booed at the press screening.
Yeah, they did.
I went to the screening.
Very ostentatiously.
I went to the screening the next morning where there was just like 15 people in a place that held 300 people.
And a friend of mine went to watch Regular Lovers, who's very diligent generally, but had been going through a bad patch, so I went to see it at the Cinema Village. And the projector, like, caught on fire after half an hour.
Cinema Village.
When that happens.
But, like, it's just, like, I think it's hilarious that Variety is, like, oh, after the success of Regular Lovers,
the huge success, oh my God.
It changed the world,
well,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
The funniest thing I heard, I saw Regular Lovers in Toronto. The funniest thing I heard after the screening was, like, well, even Jonathan Rosenbaum thought it was too long.
I bet he doesn't think that anymore. I think this should go on the record is that there's three acts, very distinct three acts. The first act, you're watching and you're like, this is a really well done French romance, it's a little slight. The second act starts and you're like, what the fuck does this have to do with the first act? What's happening? I don't know.
Right.
And then that effect happens where somebody appears in a mirror and you're like, oh shit, that's how it all connects, and it's brilliant and it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And then the third act happens and the third act
it is brilliant.
Okay.
You're not going to get us to...
We're both in love with it. And
we love it.
Obviously, we're not Leslie Halperin.
Well, Karina, let me ask you, since I've asked Glenn to wrap up Cannes from his perspective, let's wrap up Cannes from your perspective. Okay.
Well, this is my first Cannes.
Okay.
I had no idea what to expect. I was really happy. I mean, I felt like I saw a greater ratio of great films to bad films than I've seen at any festival, certainly this year.
Okay.
I was just coming off of Tribeca, where I saw four films that were, you know, worth talking about, as opposed to like 12 films that were worth throwing in a garbage can and setting on fire. But I was really happy with Ken. And actually, on my flight back, I had a direct flight from Nice to New York, and I sat next to Amy Talman, and she was talking about how shitty the festival was, and the only movie she liked was Che. And I just, you know, I couldn't agree with her.
Right. And are you going back next year?
If I can afford it, absolutely. I mean, it depends on what my career situation is.
The great thing about Cannes is that, like, I can look back on it now and say what a pain in the ass certain things about it were, and how, like, what the fuck was... I was standing there thinking, what the hell was I thinking wanting to come back? And yet now, my thing is, I'm dying to go back next year.
Okay. Cool. Well, we'll wrap up this section of the podcast.
Are we going to take a cigarette break and then talk about everyone?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Oh,
as Vadim spills his beer,
And my mom cries her tears, her salty.
We shall wrap up this section of we shall wrap up this episode of Lichtman and Rizov. Thank you for listening, and talk to you later.